What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Monsieur le Président, est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire quel sera le premier prix? Can you tell me which prize is the first prize?
Yes, I can.
Mais oui.
Cool.
The film that won the Palme d'Or is Titan.
Wait,
the
no!
Film qui a reçu la
Titan can't even win a prestigious award without making a scene.
No blood, though, as I recall. That was Cannes jury president Spike Lee back in July, accidentally announcing the film's Palme d'Or win way too early in the ceremony. But however shocking that was to French festival goers, I think it's fair to say that it was nothing compared to what they saw on the screen, Josh.
I think in French, Titan means intense.
I didn't take French in high school, but maybe so. This week, we've got a review of director Julia Ducournau's provocative new film, along with the second film in our Jane Campion oeuvre review, 1990's An Angel at My Table.
That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. We're pretty well acquainted with New Zealand actors and directors here on the show. Peter Jackson, Taika Waititi, Russell Crowe, Anna Paquin, not to mention our current oeuvre review subject, Jane Campion. But Josh, devoted reader that you are, husband of a librarian, how are you with New Zealand literature?
Well, is J.R.R. Tolkien, was he from New Zealand? I know that's where they filmed all Lord of the Rings movies, but no, of course I know he was not. So yeah, not too acquainted with New Zealand literature.
Okay, well, our producer Sam has given us some notes here. There's a short story writer, Catherine Mansfield, Booker Prize winner, Kelly Holm. Sam recommends The Bone People, if you're curious, and the novelist of Whale Rider. We can add someone else to the list now. With the help of Jane Campion, we have now acquainted ourselves with New Zealand novelist and poet Janet Frame, the subject of Campion's 1990 film, An Angel at My Table.
Speaking of the library, I've got her novel, The Edge of the Alphabet. It's sitting there waiting for me. I just got to go pick it up, Adam. So I'm going to catch up on this.
That bodes well for our discussion. It sounds like you were moved by the second film in our series. We will get to that film and more later in the show.
But first, we now know how to pronounce Titan. Do we have any idea what to say about it?
I am, for potentially many reasons, probably not the target viewer for Julia Ducournau's movies, but I'll give you two. She told The Independent in April 2017 that her aim with Raw, her debut feature about a young veterinary student who develops a taste for human flesh, was to provoke a physical reaction. Then you have shared something with your neighbor in the cinema, she explained. As it so happens, I've consumed both Raw and Ducournau's latest, Titan, alone on my couch. But speaking of going to the cinema, we'll occasionally apply the multiplex test to poll question options, movies we're most anticipating. If you could only see one movie playing that day and you'd never get to see the others, going only off the title and the director, which theater do you sit down in? Well, if instead we replace directors with genres, I'm not really sure which one I'd select, but I know the last one I'd choose. Body horror. Despite my appreciation for several movies that qualify, including the work of David Cronenberg, gruesome injuries, medical procedures, mutilations, animal to human or human to animal transformations. No, thank you. In fairness, Ducournau's work can't be so easily labeled. I think it's a crossover between comedy, drama, and body horror, she told The Independent in a separate piece. It has a lot of comedic scenes. That quote, too, is in reference to Raw, but just as plainly applies to Titan, which boasts the best plot synopsis of any movie this year. Titan, a metal highly resistant to heat and corrosion with high tensile strength alloys, often used in medical prosthesis due to its pronounced biocompatibility.
Mm.
No, Ducournau has not moved on to making industrial movies, though I am now morbidly curious at the thought of a movie consisting solely of scenes depicting horrific workplace accidents. But the tagline's elusiveness, its playfulness, is appropriate for a movie that truthfully isn't just body horror or drama or comedy. It's also, at least, a women's revenge movie, a gender identity movie, father and son slash twisted family reunion movie. What it isn't is a straight-up horror movie. I can't say there's anything that's ever actually scary in Titan, which is almost certainly by design. Here's Ducournau again talking about Raw. I didn't make this movie for it to be scary. When I watch horror, and I watch four horror movies a week, I am searching for one that is going to really scare me. I want to be scared, to jump out of my seat and yell. But I did not make this movie like that. I didn't use jump scares. You are disturbed. That's my aim. To shake you to the core. To disturb a viewer. To shake one to the core. My body horror sensitivity aside, that strikes me as a noble pursuit for any filmmaker. Is that visceral reaction, that revulsion, enough? Or, to be actually shook, does the revulsion, no matter how artistically rendered and thoroughly wrought, require something more profound? And if so, is Titan a triumph?
Yeah, what's interesting, Adam, is I think if you remove the body horror or the horror genre in general from this, we are often on opposite sides of it, where I demand movies that are set out to be provocations. I think I demand exactly what you just described, something beyond that impulse. I think maybe this comes up. This is where we split on Tarantino sometimes, for example. I don't seek this sort of material out. I do seek horror out. I wouldn't put Titan in the classification of horror. I don't seek this sort of like violent provocation material out. But what I responded to so much about Raw is I thought it had those elements, but also had a lot of ideas behind it. That's why it made my top 10 list. And it was, you know, just to sum it up in a way that's not fair to the movie at all, but I felt it had a lot to say about the human appetite. And so, yeah, ask that question of me with Titan. And I would say, putting it out there, that I still appreciated this movie. I like it. But I felt that drive to provoke or unsettle the audience as a stronger impetus to making this film and putting on screen what's on the screen than there was in Raw. There was something just sort of organically volcanic about the disturbances in Raw. That here seems calculated is too strong of a word, but I somewhat felt the pressure perhaps of a filmmaker wanting to up the ante a little bit. And that doesn't mean that anything in here isn't provocatively interesting. There are certainly ideas at play here. The one you talked about, the one you named, Adam, with the sort of gender identity, the more I think about this movie, and it's up there on the screen in ways we may talk about, we may not. We're going to have to dance around this movie quite a bit in terms of spoilers. It is up there on the screen, but the more I sit with it, I think about how much in terms of what this movie has, meaningful-wise, has to do with that, I think. So there are ideas here for sure. They're maybe just not as organic as they were in Raw for me. And I think that's the difference. If a movie is going to shake me to the core, it has to be more than that tactile response that good horror gives us. It has to be something that's going to also psychologically shake me, spiritually shake me, make me sort of like feel shaken still a couple of days later beyond the actual images that were on the screen. Titan is giving me a lot to think about a couple of days later. I don't know that it shook me to the core, but that's also not to say, I mean, this thing's rough. And there were moments where I looked away from the screen, and I'm not trying to put up a brave front here that this thing didn't get to me. It absolutely did. Just maybe not provocatively isn't it. It not quite as deeply as Raw did, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I had no idea how you responded to this movie overall or how you would respond to my prompt there. And you're right. I'm usually the provocation guy. I'm the guy who's a little bit more lenient when it comes to movies that I suppose surprise me with the levels they go to shock. Now, when I think about the best movies that do that for me, I think I usually do find something to connect with, whether it's, as you said, psychologically or spiritually, just personally. There is a specific experience being depicted on screen, just like the one that's happening here, as absurd and as bizarre as it may be. It is very specific, and it may not be in any way, shape, or form my specific experience, but I can still see the universality in it, or I can see myself in it. Usually that's the case with the really good provocations. And really, as we often do with our setups, Josh, I was voicing there a question that I'm just going to be honest, I am still wrestling with when it comes to this movie. I lean towards one side, and I really was curious to have this discussion and see where you were and see if maybe by the end of it, I come out in a different place. But I had a very similar response to this movie in terms of feeling that impetus to unsettle. I think you said it really well. It is absolutely brimming with ideas. We talked about all the different types of movie this feels like. And yet at the same time, it's not as if it feels like it's not controlled or it's not all part of the same vision. Du Courneau has tremendous control over,
absolutely,
over all of it.
Incredible filmmaker.
Yeah, it feels coherent and cohesive in a way, while at the same time, I'm not sure any of those individual ideas do come together to add up to something bigger. At least they didn't for me. And I think the other thing I would say is, even if it's not something where I feel I can clearly express it or talk about it in terms of any kind of message or moral or lesson or something I took away from it, more often than not with these types of films, really with any film we talk about, Josh, the really good ones, I just think about the moments that linger with me. And you said how, you know, you're still thinking about this movie a few days later. And I did just watch it today as we're taping. But even right now, it's interesting to me how, as disturbed I may have been in the moment, seeing certain gory scenes play out, as much as I wanted to look away or maybe even did look away, and I was anticipating these moments with pure dread, it's funny to me how easy it is to actually then forget that.
Mm.
You know, 24, 48 hours later,
yeah,
other than maybe talking to someone else, having that shared experience where you go, oh yeah, that was the one that got me. But short of that, what I didn't feel here are any of those moments that really lingered. And yeah. I think that there are some moments where I feel as if Du Courneau was trying to inject true provocation. Some of the, again, we're going to dance around it, some embraces between characters that, let's say, don't make sense. There's nothing about them that make matter-of-fact sense in the real world, but I think are supposed to be powerful, and I didn't feel it. And maybe it's because of that impetus to unsettle. That did feel to me like it was overriding or overpowering the moments that may have actually really stayed with me or actually provoked a really complicated response. I didn't have that here. Did you with any particular scenes or moments?
Yeah, let's get back to, we should say some spoiler talk at the end of this. And I want to revisit your question about embraces, because I think that's interesting. And we really can't do it unless we've spoiled things. I will say this is where, I'm glad you said that. It really clarifies things for me. This is one of the reasons why I do prefer Raw, is because as you're talking, I can picture exact moments in Raw that years later still come flooding back to me. And yes, I just watched Teton yesterday, and we were talking beforehand, still have not like transcribed any notes. It's just been a blur of 24 hours. So very much a process, still processing review, but I would agree. There are not those moments that continue to disturb me until I work to recall them. So I think that is a fair point. But let's get into a little bit of the actual plot, and maybe we can talk some more in detail. And I can maybe bring something up that I did appreciate about it and see if it resonates with you. Do you think it's fair to talk about the two main characters in this film and how they are initially connected. Is that, I mean, it doesn't happen until about 20, 30 minutes in maybe, but I don't know if it constitutes a spoiler. On-air production meeting during the review, how do you feel about that? And maybe this question serves as a warning to those who really don't want to know anything that they might want to skip ahead here even before we get to spoiler.
Yeah, if you're really into that plot synopsis that's all about corrosion and metals,
we're going to go one level more.
Yeah, we are going to go at least one level more. And I'm with you. I will say, I don't consider where you're going to necessarily be spoilers. This is a tough movie in some ways to spoil anyway. But I'll admit that the character that you're going to mention, the character that our main character comes in contact with, and then that relationship is really what dominates the rest of the film, that is something you don't anticipate at all coming, or at least I didn't. I don't know how you could anticipate anything.
No, I didn't either.
This film.
I didn't either. So that's a fair warning, I think. But in order to have like a discussion worth listening to, I think we do have to talk about these two main characters. So the first person we meet is Alexia, played by Agatha Roussel. And we meet her as a young child in the prologue, very brief, and then as a young adult later. And let's just say, again, we're going to dance around this. She finds herself on the run. Let's just say that at this point, on the run, trying to hide. Yeah. And as part of that, she decides to disguise herself as a child who had gone missing 10, maybe 15 years earlier. She sees there's all these like news reports that this child is still missing. Here's how he would look now, being older, and she disguises herself as this boy who would now be a young man and pretends and poses as this young man who our second character, Vincent, played by Vincent Linden, it was his son who disappeared. And so he is called in by the police when she turns herself in and is presenting as this son, Adrian. And he takes her in. He is a captain at a fire station, runs basically, a firehouse where there are all these men working under him, firefighters. It's a completely male situation. And she continues to pose as this supposedly lost son. So I'm setting all that up, Adam, to ask you this. In terms of the one thing that I did connect with it. And that was this juxtaposition that Duke Arnault seems to be setting up. Let's just say in Alexia's previous life as this young woman, she's involved in life taking. Okay. I'll just leave it there. When she encounters Vincent, obviously his profession is one of life saving, and he actually takes her in as a trainee, thinking again that it's his lost son. And there is a really compelling moment. Here's a scene that probably does stand out to me. And interestingly, it's not provocative at all. She, as a trainee, as a trainee, is called to respond to a son who has probably overdosed, a mother who is panicking about this. And how she gets involved in that scene turns her into a lifesaver, let's just say. And I think this was the really interesting tension in the movie that I did latch onto, is this journey of this deeply, deeply disturbed and disturbing young woman. She is not a heroine, I don't think, at all. Going from experiences of life taking to life saving. And I should also say Vincent, played by Vincent Linden, is not a purely like heroic angelic. He comes in to save her. He has disturbing issues of his own. Mm-hmm. But the way these two people meet and that push and pull between to take a life or save a life, to me held me through everything that happened, even as we also got these severe moments of, as you said, body horror, bizarre plot turns. I mean, this thing, I'm probably making this sound more every day than it is. The places this movie goes are insane, but it still had that sort of common trajectory that held me through it. Does that kind of like sell you a little bit on what this movie might be interested in?
It does, but only a little bit. And the way it does is that I remember that scene very vividly too. I think it is because of all the things you talked about, including that it is the first moment where we have seen from this character really any act of compassion or empathy or anything that strikes us as actual human behavior, quote unquote human behavior. It's in that scene. Now, I'm not completely sure what then Ducorneau is up to with that. And just as you're starting to contemplate all of that, the movie then takes some other twist,
takes another twisted turn, and
wants to hit you with something else. And I will go back to another element of her story. You did allude to it already, and I think it probably happens early enough in the film that I would say this isn't a spoiler either. I will still dance around it and say that that compulsion of hers, the behavior and activity that she regularly engages in, I'm curious for your response on this, Josh. It struck me as, we'll go back to the P word at least one more time, more provocation than anything, a sort of societal taboo, and we're going to revel a little bit in this character utilizing her power and subjugating people. Now, there are some scenes where the people she's subjugating are men.
Mm-hmm.
They're men. This is where the women's revenge angle comes
in.
They are men who are trying to take advantage of her. Or maybe if you don't think they're really going too far with that, they are still, let's say, being inappropriate or just getting too close to her.
But I'm going to back you up even more, Adam. She seeks some of them out.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Is that not that I need an easy explanation from Ducorneau to provide the motivation.
Justification.
And some psychology or some kind of justification. But there is something you want to latch onto there a little bit.
I agree.
To unlock some of these other elements of the movie that we're talking about versus it feeling a little bit like, you know, art house fun, if you will. But there wasn't a sense for me watching it that there was any kind of underlying clear motivation or even semi-clear motivation that would have allowed me, as I said, to not only unlock some of these other kind of colliding storylines and elements and psychologies that are being introduced, but it would give me an idea that I really want to ponder, that I really want to consider, that does seem to me like an idea that viewers of this film need to contend with. But because of the inconsistency, it seemed to me there, because of the drive of this character to seek out those types of experiences, it did leave me wondering if I perhaps just missed something. Do you feel that we did?
I think that's totally fair. And I think it's most glaring in the scene where she goes back to a house on a date with a character we only meet briefly, Justine, played actually by Garance Marier, who was so great as the lead in Raw.
And by the way, wasn't her name Justine?
Yes, that sounds right. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I think that scene at that house is the most glaring of what you're talking about, where the use of music, it gets a little actually like, aren't we all having fun here as we're deeply horrified?
It becomes a comedy. Yeah. It becomes a comedy that scene.
Right. And maybe that was intentional. Again, not something I usually go for. Here's a slight counter I would offer. I think so much of the understanding of this character, Alexia, is rooted in that prologue where she's a child and there is a ton of subtext. It's a brief scene. Again, we'll not spoil how it ends, of her in the back seat while her father is driving. And there's so much passive aggressiveness going on between the two of them and where that scene ends. I think the movie is insinuating a ton there that might be picked up on later in the film in ways perhaps we'll get into in spoilers. Sure. I think that is our glimpse into Alexia's psychology. And I agree with you, though. I don't know if it's entirely enough if you are a viewer like you and I, and not all viewers are, who want to have some way into a character like this. One of the challenges for me was to ask, once I realized this, again, life-taking and life-saving dichotomy was playing out, how far am I willing to go to save a life that I think is not worth saving because of what that character had done? Mm. And I think, to me, talking about something that is more, you know, like soul shaking or whatever. It's that question. It's like, when are you going to give up on someone when you see a character who has not given up on someone like that? Is that more challenging to you? You know? And so I think there's something like that there, but I also agree with you that, it's really hard to connect with this character. And maybe that's where we can talk about the performances and get to a little more text here. What did you make of this performance? Agatha Roussel, I believe, is, you know, a newcomer, and she's in almost every frame. Yeah. Vincent Linden, as we said, comes in and becomes just, you know, becomes a two-person story at some point. I just saw this as I was looking up a few things before we started recording. He actually, I knew I recognized him, and he's been in a ton of stuff, but for me, it was Claire Denis' Friday Night. And I think there's a lot of Denis in this movie, especially when it comes to, like, sex and violence, actually. So obviously Denis is an influence on Du Cornel. But yeah, what did you make of these two performances from Linden and Roussel?
Yeah, I was really wowed by Linden's performance. And Roussel, I think my struggle with that performance comes back to the struggle we're trying to express with the movie overall, which is, you're right, it's hard. It's so hard to connect with this character, which goes so far beyond simply saying that this is a character who does bad things that I don't appreciate. It is way more complex.
Yeah, we're both on record that we don't, we're fine with doing, with identifying with bad characters.
Yeah, not judging the morality here necessarily of the character, at least not in this context. But it is a difficult performance in a lot of ways, too. I think a challenging one to pull off that Roussel does for the most part, because they're is very little that she actually expresses verbally. It is almost a complete physical performance. There is so much of it that is nonverbal. And so I did find myself at times really being amazed by the nuances to her reactions, especially when she is interacting with Linden. And so much of it is her trying to protect herself and keep a distance. And there's two notes being played at once. There's the note that is, she really doesn't know this person and doesn't want that type of intimacy or to be vulnerable. But she's also just protecting herself, too, in the sense that she doesn't want to be exposed as a fraud. And so she's always kind of trying to keep a distance. So I was impressed with that. And then there were other times where I felt like I was watching a prolonged scowl. You know, there is that face, which, don't get me wrong, it's very expressive. It's very intimidating. I said there was nothing scary about this movie. That face, when Roussel turns and glares at you, is maybe the scariest thing in the movie. But I also, I'm just going to admit, felt like it kind of dominated the performance in a way where maybe I was looking for just a little bit more of that humanity to come through. And that's the problem. This is a character who fundamentally, that's the journey, if we go to your reading of the film, that's the journey this character's on, and you have to be willing to go through the challenging parts of that with the character.
Yeah, I mean, what an ask of a fairly novice performer, a role like this, because you're right. We didn't mention, but when she begins to pose as Adrian, she, for obvious reasons, chooses not to speak, which Vincent accepts because who knows what trauma he thinks, you know, that his son has been through. And so it makes sense, but also takes away a huge tool for an actor, you know? And so to think about it that way, it is an impressive performance. It, you know, it's almost as if, given, and this would involve spoilers, but I think we can say in terms of body horror, the things she does to herself to try to appear as this son, she breaks her own nose, an extended scene in an airport bathroom we have to watch. It's almost as if her body becomes an art installation project for Du Cornel. And
yeah.
And I think that's part of the trouble, is we're not used to, we want more human connection with the people we see on screen. And this character is almost treated as an art installation project, which may be part of the limitations. Now, this is also, we understand, a character who has caused and, I, in my reading, endured great trauma. And so there, it's that sense that I think made me feel, if not connected to him, her, her, him, at least like willing to sit with the disconnect in a way, understanding that experience. And then as far as Lyndon goes, what I appreciated is what I was trying to hint at before. My synopsis may sound like him just swooping in as the savior of this other character. And I don't think that's the case at all. He's a deeply traumatized person in his own way. And the switching back and forth from someone who wants to express care, but also has been so hurt he may not know how to anymore, is really deft and incredibly impressive. So yeah, I would say Lyndon is definitely the standout.
Yeah, I think there is a lot more we could say about this movie. We only alluded to some of the filmmaking, and I think the sound design here, like with Raw, is another key element.
Color scheme.
The film. The color scheme for sure. But yeah, that sound, you mentioned the opening scene and you danced around it a little bit, but we've all seen so many movies that the moment any film opens on a scene of a family driving, any members of a family and a kid in the back seat, we know what's coming. Unfortunately, we know exactly what's coming. But unless I sort of just experienced it incorrectly, Josh, what I loved actually was the way Ducournau, with the sound, blended, and it makes sense, right, as we watch the rest of the film play out, blended the person, the character, with the machine. And it's that sound, it's that humming that she's doing that's driving her father crazy in the front seat.
Yes.
And we don't even know for sure. We don't know that it's her making that sound because of the way the camera starts underneath the car, focusing on the metal, focusing on the mechanics of the car. And we think it's the engine that is making that sound. And it is, but it's also her. And there is instantly this kind of melding of the flesh and the machine, which again is really what this movie's about in a lot of ways.
It is. And that another influence, Cronenberg, you mentioned, body horror, master body horror and something like Crash. But yeah, even before she makes that sound, just the filmmaking of those the undercarriage of the car, where we get the mechanical parts, but then we also get the dripping. We get the fluid where suddenly it becomes something a little more biological, which will pay off, of course, later in the film. And going back to the lighting scheme, it isn't until we get to Vincent's character that we realize so much of it has been inspired by that particular pinkish red you get on a fire engine's light spinning around. It's not the light if you look at it. It's the light that's coming out of it if you're kind of looking sideways. And that pops up so often in this film, which is really effective as kind of like setting the table for where it's going to go.
Titan is currently playing in limited release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Do you want to get into a little spoiler talk, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, real quickly, it's just stuff I want to ask somebody who's seen this, and you're the only person I've talked to who's seen this.
I'm the guy here.
You're the guy here, so okay. Am I kind of like back reading this, though? I swear it was my first instinct. Do you think Vincent, the minute those blinds go up and he looks at Alexia posing as Adrian, my guess is he knew instantaneously that was not his son, but decided maybe this will fill my hurt.
I love that the movie leaves that ambiguity open.
Yeah, it's not clear.
It isn't. And we as viewers are really studying his face in that moment and trying to see what he betrays. And I think that's one moment where we talk about kind of finding a personal in. You imagine yourself as a parent in a terrible scenario like that. And would you, as he says, as we all think, would you be able to identify your son? Would you know your own son or your own daughter, even if it was all those years later, because you just believe that there is that bond and that connection and you don't need anyone to tell you, you don't need a test to confirm it? I think he does believe that. Now, whether or not he instantly questions that and realizes that that's not the case in that moment, and what we're seeing is that revelation, not only that revelation, but then that decision to basically acknowledge that he is so lonely.
Yes.
And so in need of filling this void in his life that he's willing to pretend. And yeah, I definitely don't think the movie gives a clear answer. There is another point in the movie, maybe later, and we could also try to pinpoint this, where he becomes very aware of, let's say, her circumstances, her slash his.
We're in spoiler talk now. So.
Yeah, you're right. I guess we are. And even
becomes
that,
aware of the car baby, Adam. Yeah, the car baby.
And even then, or before then, there's a moment where he says, "I would accept you, you know, no matter who you are,
yes,
and what your body is like." And you wonder, well, was he already aware not only that it's not his child, but that it's actually a woman pretending to be a young man? I think
that comes later.
I definitely think that comes later.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think in that moment, I guess I'm just going to say, I think it's completely ambiguous in the best artistic way, that it can absolutely be either one.
And this goes back to the greatness of Lyndon's performance too, right? To be able to walk that line in that scene when you're exactly right. We're looking at him so closely. So this is related. There's a fire training sequence where they're in a building, there are flames all around. They can be extinguished. It's like controlled. He's with some of his younger firefighters, and they open a cabinet. He looks in it, and there's this figure of a small child on fire, and he freaks out. So is that supposed to be his son? And does that imply, and this goes to me thinking, like, this guy is not some sort of visiting angel necessarily. Does that imply maybe he knew in some way that his son died in a fire and hid that by claiming he disappeared, and that there's a whole nother layer of guilt and trauma this guy is dealing with that might explain some of his extreme behavior in trying to accept Alexia as Adrian? I don't know if that's a step too far, though.
Well, it might be, but it's a brilliant step too far. I think it's really fascinating. It's something I didn't consider at all. That's a very kind of sinister, malevolent reading that does open up a lot of avenues to consider. I didn't see it that way, though. I think I had the same initial reaction you did. I think anybody watching the film, I would imagine most people would have that same reaction, where it's impossible to look at the figure of what seems to be a little boy, as charred as it might be. It's clearly a human figure.
Child, yeah.
A child who is kind of nestled within a cabinet or within something.
Yeah.
And you see his reaction, and knowing the past, knowing his past, the child he's been missing all these years, you do wonder if that is meant to be or to represent that kid. And I guess I saw it a little bit more symbolically, or saw it as a little bit more of an apparition in a way, just because I guess if we're going to talk about it in realistic terms, are you suggesting that's really where the kid has been all of these years?
I don't know, but now you're making me feel like I went too dark, because the basic reading is just it was a way to connect us with his trauma, that when he may always imagine, I don't want to think about what you might do if your child went missing, is like, where could they be? And he's in this life or death scenario, and is maybe there just envisioning, maybe it's something that happens to him a lot,
right,
where he gets this vision of his child in peril and he can't do anything about it.
Maybe.
So that's a little, I mean, it's still dark, but it's not as dark as I went. So let's just go with that.
Wow. On that note.
Well, wait.
Probably should.
One more thing, real quick. You mentioned the emotional, the hugs or the embraces, the embraces. I wanted I want to hear a little more about that from you, and which ones held you up, because I think it ties. If I follow you correctly, it might tie back to what we were talking about in terms of Alexia's motivations. Isn't the right word, but psychology.
Okay. Well, it's the first time that we see them, Vincent and Alexia, actually embrace. He, as I recall, hugs her, or she kind of puts, it's not the scene where she puts her head on his chest. That's later. They're laying down in that scene. There is another embrace that happens before that. It might be that scene where he says to her that he accepts her, how she is. And in that moment, I really thought that considering the whacked out movie I was watching, and this connection between two characters that seems so unattainable that I would be a little bit more caught up in it. I would frankly be more moved by it. And at that point, at that point in the film, I didn't feel it. Now, I know that's just a completely subjective response. Many people watching it maybe felt otherwise, but that's the embrace I was thinking of.
And is that the scene you mentioned where, no, it's not where they say, I love you and I love you too. That's the final one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you're talking about the scene where he says, I don't care who you are.
Yes.
Something like that. I'll accept you anyway.
Yes.
I did find that moving. Where I thought you might be going is the final one, which we will say the birth of the car baby, which I'm sorry, I know this may spoil for you, Adam, but baby Annette thought she had, you know, this year locked up as weird baby of the year.
No.
Sorry. Sorry, baby Annette.
Yeah. No.
Nice
no,
try.
Baby. Car baby takes the cake. It has to. I haven't seen Annette yet, but you know.
But anyway, so that is a really complicated moment just before that whole crazy birth scene where it does turn sexual between them. And the person making that move. So a lot of the kissing beforehand, I was kind of writing off, not that I'm any expert, but as French. Like, you know, they kiss each other in the cheek. There's more, you know, it's just like, that's I'm from the Midwest. We don't do that. We don't do that stuff. So I was like, okay, whatever. Cultural differences. It did seem to get a little weird in that last scene pre-birth. And I do think she makes a move. Now, okay, I'm being a prude. Lay the facts out. They're not blood relatives. He knows that at this point. They have clearly established a parent-child relationship. So I still think it's a little strange. But I do think this suggests possibly that part of the root of Alexia's trauma may be tied to her father.
Yeah.
And that there's more going on in that brief prologue than passive aggressiveness. And this may be the only way she understands you relate to someone who's sort of a father figure. That's kind of why, as like deeply troubling, and it's one of those scenes where you're like, no, don't go there. Please don't go there. I'm dealing with car baby.
Right.
I've got a lot on my plate right
but
now.
But you also knew it's a French film, so it was going to, is what you're saying.
So that's kind of, that's the only way I could connect it with the other things we had been experiencing.
Yeah. Well, you're right that in that opening scene, that skirmish that happens is brought on. I don't remember who, bad phrase to use in this context, but makes the first move. But the father very clearly like reaches for her or tries to touch her or grab her in a way that then kind of sets some things off in the car.
Yeah. She unbuckles her seatbelt.
Exactly. Yeah. And he reaches and that's something we see with other men later in the film. Right.
And that doesn't
end well when that happens. But also there is that scene where it's suggested, I think, that he must be a doctor because he examines her because he says because she says she's not feeling well.
She's older at this point. Yeah.
She's older. And doesn't she like try to keep his hand on her stomach? And that feels a little incestuous. Like she was trying to.
She does. But then I think she's the one who like runs away at that point, too.
Hmm.
So that's a weird one where, it's kind of like she seems cool with it and then suddenly is out of there, if I'm remembering correctly.
I kind of interpreted that as her anger with him for not reciprocating.
But possible.
It's just funny. This makes me think of, I mentioned a couple times in the setup, the article I found in The Independent. It was just because I needed a nugget like shaken to the core. I saw that and I'm like, okay, you know, just going to be honest, I can build a setup around that, especially with this movie. And in it, another thing she said that I almost called out, but I had already referenced enough quotes, was she was talking about Rostill, and she said that there are three taboos that film just doesn't really know what to do with. And they were cannibalism. There's Raw.
Yeah.
And the other two were murder and incest. And I'm like, okay, so she's just going to make the trilogy, you know, like
check,
now she's gone from Raw, right, to now murder in this film. And we get the hints of incest that may then set up, who knows, another film.
I mean, and there's Claire Denis again with High Life. So, yeah, if you want to be, if not shaken to the core, deeply unsettled, either sure. Claire Denis or Julia Ducournau is for you.
Yeah.
Also, maybe Jane Campion? I mean, I think we'll get into that as our overview proceeds, but I do think An Angel at My Table is a little less provocative of her features. That is going to be the Campion film we discuss next. We'll also have the results of the film spotting poll. We asked you, who should be the next James Bond? Stay with us.
You don't want your clothing or your kitchenware to come, is that what you mean?
We can't leave the piano.
Let's not discuss this any further.
That hurts, Anna Paquin. We had, when we moved, Adam, we downsized. We had to leave the piano. And here, a young Anna Paquin is rubbing it in. That was from her Oscar-winning performance in Jane Campion's The Piano, which came out in 1993. We're going to get to that film next week as part of our Campion overview. I don't know how this is going to go, Adam. I'm very excited to watch The Piano again. I don't know how excited I am to hear your response to it because your first viewing did not go so well. 2.5 stars on Letterboxd? Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. Did you commit the sin of doing 2.5 stars plus the heart?
No. See, unlike you, I literally never do that. There is never a time. I will always force myself.
You have your critical standards.
To go without the heart. No like for 2.5, even though, you know, that's the conundrum of film criticism here. You give something 2.5 and it doesn't mean you necessarily hate it. But no, I can't go as far as you, Josh, and be wishy-washy with the hearts.
Wow.
I did. This is so rare these days. Not only do I seldom actually even give star ratings anymore on Letterboxd, I almost never actually say anything about the movie. And
I've
here I've got
that.
I got a paragraph about The Piano that kind of makes sense. So you know what? I'm gonna set it aside. I'm gonna pretend I've never seen the movie. I'm gonna pretend I didn't have a mixed 2.5 star reaction. And I'm gonna see if maybe watching these films in order allows me to have a new appreciation for Campion's masterpiece, or at least her most acclaimed film.
I think that's a good strategy. I usually try, when we do these revisits, I usually try to not even look at what I wrote before anywhere and just experience it as fresh as I can. So that makes me a little more hopeful.
I am hopeful as well. Campion's The Piano is next week. More info about our OOVE review at filmspotting.net/Campion. The Piano is currently streaming on Netflix and is available to rent on most platforms. Next week on the show, we actually don't know what we're doing. And maybe if we had taken some time to write down some options, we could have an on-air production meeting about next week's show. And listeners could even vote. We planned to talk about No Time to Die, the Bond film that we have been prepping for, we've been doing our homework for. But alas, it does seem like the screening times are going to conspire against me, Josh. And I don't think that a No Time to Die review for the week it opens is going to be feasible. So most people listening to this show, they'll get to tune in the week after they've had a chance to see No Time to Die, and we'll all have a bunch of Bond fun together.
Well, it's interesting because I went to the No Time to Die screening today at 2, and I think I'm still in it. I might still be in that screening. Isn't that Michael Phillips joke?
Yeah. Yeah.
He usually pulls that out. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Okay.
So, yeah, whenever you get to see it, set aside a good, I don't know if it hits 3 hours, but it's close.
Okay. Too much Bond, Josh might be suggesting. Next week, we might do a preview of our great local Chicago Film Festival, our top 5 movies we want to catch at the fest. That opens on October 13th. You'll just have to tune in to find out.
For sure next week will be Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene from a movie and you get a chance at winning a Film Spotting t-shirt. In case you missed it, here's a bit of our last massacre. Pity I can't see behind the mask.
We all wear masks.
My life's an open book. You read it.
I don't blend in at a family picnic.
Oh, we could give it a try. I'll bring the wine, you bring your scarred psyche. Not sure I did that one justice, Adam. I'd like another swing at that scene, but you were great. I really...
Well, yeah. Yeah, greatness in blandness was what I was going for. And here's a hint, maybe. I think this actor is great. I'm not sure he's so good in this scene, and I'm not sure he's so good in this movie. I don't recall if I've ever seen it. I may have watched parts, but I'm not sure I actually sat through all of this sequel. There's another hint.
Okay. 2 out of 4 stars for me at LarsonOnFilm.com. Unfortunately, I have not employed the heart emoji on my website. Yeah. So I'm going to say if it was 2.5 on Letterboxd, no heart for this one, Adam.
No, okay, no heart.
No heart. If you know what film we massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, October 4. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
This week over on our sister podcast, How About This Pairing? I've seen both films. I really like both films. I can't wait to dive into this one. The next picture show, their pairing is The Card Counter, the latest from Paul Schrader, and Paul Thomas Anderson's Hard Eight. You got gambling. You got redemption. You got surrogate fathers. It's all there.
I love it. Yeah. And they're both like gambling movies that are really not about gambling at all. So that works too.
It really does. The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. If you're not listening every week, we don't know why, and you really should. New episodes post every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. More info at nextpictureshow.net. Also, a plug for our friends, Scott and Keith. They have a new Substack newsletter. It's called The Reveal, which is a reader-supported newsletter dedicated to bringing you great essays, reviews, and conversation about movies, and, in parentheses, a little TV. Their first issue just went out earlier this week, Josh.
Subscribed myself. I'm already a subscriber. Would encourage everyone to do this. I saw both of them at No Time to Die, and what I love is that this is going to give them a chance to write about the stuff, maybe like No Time to Die, but also more curious things that they're particularly interested in that they necessarily haven't been able to working primarily as freelancers the last couple of years where they're taking assignments. And this is going to be their shot to do what they did at The Dissolve. Is like, we don't care how popular it might be. This is what we're passionate about. This is what we want to write about. And I think that's what the readers who have been following them for so many years have appreciated is getting their perspective on that sort of stuff. So yeah, this is really exciting. I can't wait to see what the two of them are going to do.
More info is available at thereveal.substack.com. And if you like interacting with Scott and Keith, I'm just going to throw out there that they both might be joining an upcoming edition of Trivia Spotting, which is our monthly pub style trivia event that we do exclusively for Film Spotting family members over on Patreon. $5 a month gets you benefits, including access to those Trivia Spotting events. Tickets are on sale right now. Friday, October 8th, 7 p.m. Central Time is the next one. Going to have some returning players, some returning captains like Scott and Keith. Scott has played once. Keith has done maybe 3 or 4.
Yeah, I was going to say, I couldn't remember if Scott had done it, but he had. Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
We'll have them on as a pair this time, as well as, again, some other great captains. And if you are a Film Spotting family member, you also know that you get our monthly bonus episodes. This month, September, we went down to the wire again, Josh, as far as getting this one in and publishing it, but we made it in the month of September, a twofer. You got the third installment in our mini James Bond marathon prepping for No Time to Die. We talked about Timothy Dalton's debut, The Living Daylights. We talked about Pierce Brosnan's debut, GoldenEye. I'm going to miss these Bond movies. I'm going to miss the conversations about the Bond movies.
Yeah, it's definitely been fun. So that one's out there. I know we recorded it, but yeah, as you said, we're pushing it.
Well, Josh, in the future, when people hear this, it will be there. At the moment you and I are talking, it does not exist in the world.
We really are pushing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Annual memberships are also available. If you don't want to do the $5 a month option, you get a 10% discount. You get a month free. You can do that. Patreon.com/filmspotting.
So you're Tatiana Romanova.
My friends call me Tanya.
My friends call me Bond. James Bond.
From his 1986 Bond audition, that was actor Sam Neill with those iconic lines. And if that brief bit of dialogue sounded familiar, maybe you, like us, recently caught up with 1963's From Russia with Love. The scene, originally with Sean Connery as Bond and Daniela Bianchi as Tanya, is reportedly the scene that all Bond hopefuls have to try out with. Let's do it, Josh. Give it a shot. I want to hear your Bond audition.
Oh, no. It's in my SAG contract, Adam. I don't do two massacre theaters a show. Come on.
Okay, fair enough. With Daniel Craig turning in his keys to the Aston Martin after No Time to Die, we couldn't resist joining in the feverish conjecture about who will be the next Bond. The current film spotting poll then asked you who should be the next Bond. The options were Riz Ahmed, John Boyega, Michael Fassbender, Tom Hardy, Daniel Kaluuya, Robert Pattinson, Dev Patel, or other, and yes, I'm sure we're going to get to this, other could have included Idris Elba, a name that has been thrown out a lot over the years, and a lot of people would love to see that. Obviously, an incredibly talented actor. As we tried to fashion and form this deeply flawed film spotting poll question, as they all are, our producer Sam had a little bit of a cutoff point when it came to the age of actors making their Bond debut. And apparently, you know, we didn't want sort of Roger Moore all over again. So well, Idris Elba left out.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Idris Elba left out of this one. Sorry, Idris. We did go with a few younger gentlemen in the role of James Bond. Potentially, Josh, how did it come out? Who would our listeners like to see most?
In last place with 9%, John Boyega. What is wrong with you
people? I think that was
your
choice.
Come on.
I think that was your choice.
Get it together, Film Spotting Nation. Robert Pattinson was next with 10%. I think that was sort
of
my
choice.
Well, and I think, you know, as we talked about, kind of a Pattinson protection vote is let's just
sure.
let him do other stuff. I mean, he's already Batman, right? Tom Hardy received 10% of the vote as well. Daniel Kaluuya, 11%. Riz Ahmed, 12%. Michael Fassbender, so beloved by this show many, mm-hmm. many years ago, only 14% of the vote. Other, to your point, Adam, a lot of people went with other, 15%. Second place. But Dev Patel took this thing with 20% of the vote.
Yeah, a lot of options there. Pretty close. Dev Patel, though, takes it. And I had completely forgotten about Robert Pattinson as the Batman.
I had
too.
Somebody pointed that out on Twitter, I think, is like he's already part of a franchise. So
how about being the actor who could actually really pull off both Batman and Bond?
That's true. Good point.
Pretty impressive. Mac Johnson here, a regular trivia spotting player, says, make mine Fassbender. The first time I saw Lieutenant Archie Hickok stroll into his M-style briefing with General Ed Fennec, I remember thinking to myself, I have no idea who this guy is, but shave that mustache and make him James Bond. A couple years later, the Argentinian bar scene in X-Men First Class was practically an audition for 007. Fassbender ticks all the usual boxes, but can also pull off an aspect of the character that many Bond actors struggle with, the murderous dandy.
Ooh.
Moore had the foppishness in spades, but sacrificed the edge. Craig has grown into it over the past couple films. Fassbender could be the first actor since Connery to nail it out of the gate, and the murderous dandy is absolutely the name of my next band.
I like that.
I say this knowing that Fassbender has all but completely aged out of the role at this point. Like another great choice, Idris Elba, Fassbender had the misfortune of breaking onto the scene right as Daniel Craig, arguably the greatest Bond of all, was just getting started. And I say misfortune because, like Elba, he really seemed to want the role. Tradition dictates that the next Bond will be a runner-up from the Craig casting. Craig himself was a fresh face at the time, but Moore, Dalton, and Brosnan had all been considered long before actually winning the role. If that holds true this go-round, it puts the spotlight on Henry Cavill, who narrowly missed out on Casino Royale. Cavill has actually aged into the part now, but his profile is likely too big to be a real contender. Chris Klemek, our buddy here, a guest on Trivia Spotting and a guest on some of our episodes, including a Bond bonus show. He is most likely right, Max says, when he says that it will probably be someone we've barely even heard of at this point. So we talked about Batman and Bond. Then we would have Superman and Bond if Cavill actually was the choice.
That's true. We also heard from Lucy, if this vote was fair, you would include some women. I know that may be far-reaching, but come on, a male Bond of color will be next, but I think it would shake up the franchise if they pulled a curveball and leaned away from their patriarchal tendencies. Michaela Cowell, Jodie Comer, Emma Watson, Psy, maybe in 2050.
Maybe, wow. Or maybe sooner. Emma Watson. I'd be interested in that, Josh, especially someone like Jodie Comer.
I got to sit down and think about Emma Watson. Hermione's Bond. I don't know. Could that
Why
work?
Not? Jordan from Toronto says Phoebe Waller-Bridge has long been film Twitter's number one choice. And who am I to disagree? She has the pluck. She has the verve. She has the wit. Maybe we can round up all the actors listed here to be her Bond boys.
Here's Jackie. John David Washington has charisma, charm, and an attitude that he just belongs in that penguin suit or diving suit or any suit, really. Would love to see him there if he's into it.
Stephen Hill closes us out. He says, I voted other and selected Tom Hiddleston. It's time for another Roger Moore type.
Oh, well, you know, I'm ready for that. And I do love Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah,
that could work.
I'm going to be mean and say he doesn't have enough hair.
Oh, my gosh.
He can't be Bond.
It's filmspotting@gmail.com. Is that I don't even know.
Yeah, you can send it there. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Either way.
.net. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, Josh doesn't want to read those, so don't send it to the feedback.
I'm not going
to
get involved in that anti-bald comment.
That brings us quickly to the latest deeply flawed film spotting poll trademark. We look ahead to the flurry of activity we're getting from Ridley Scott this fall. His The Last Duel with Matt Damon, Adam Driver, and Ben Affleck comes to theaters on the 15th. House of Gucci with Driver and Lady Gaga arrives in November. Are you looking forward to either one of those? Maybe one more than the other, Josh?
I am furiously Googling Ridley Scott's filmography because this poll, I know it's coming up, but I don't have a good answer to it. So of those two, House of Gucci. Yes, of course.
Okay. Really? I guess I'm going a little bit more pedestrian and you give me Affleck and Damon and Driver, The Last Duel. And it was one of my fall movie questions built around the unique approach to the screenplay with Damon Affleck and Nicole Holofcener. So I'm really curious about that film. Our question, not an uncommon one when considering Scott's long career, though one I don't think we have asked over 16 years of doing film spotting. We're basically wanting to know what is Ridley Scott's third best movie, because you've got 1979's Alien and 1982's Blade Runner, which are undisputed masterpieces, the ones he will forever be first associated with. But then what comes next? The options we're giving you are these, Josh.
Gladiator from 2000, a Best Picture winner. The Martian, which was Best Picture nominated. Prometheus, which was Scott's return to the alien mythos. And Thelma and Louise from 1991. Otherwise, you could vote other.
You could. Now, we'll give a little bit more context here, some more things to ponder. Scott has been nominated four times for Best Director. Gladiator, The Martian, Thelma and Louise, and Black Hawk Down. Other films you might vote for if you are so inclined to go other: Matchstick Men, American Gangster, Hannibal, Kingdom of Heaven, and Legend. Of all the films we've named.
Yes.
And you recall, I was very favorable on The Martian. I really like Thelma and Louise. I was also maybe one of the only people in the world, it seems now, that really went for Prometheus. But if I'm voting here, I'm going to admit that I still really dig Gladiator, as I did in 2000 when it came out.
Okay.
And I've always been a fan, and in the old days of the show, proselytized for Matchstick Men as yes. a really underrated film and an underrated Ridley Scott film. So I could go Gladiator or I could go other. I guess for now I'll go other. Maybe next week I'll change my mind. I'm going Matchstick Men for now as my third favorite Ridley Scott.
Good choice. I know that when Sam put this out on Twitter, there was a lot of Matchstick Men responses. So you will find your people if you go that way, Adam. And I think that's respectable. I do like that movie. All my furious Googling to remind myself, I mean, Ridley Scott has made like 300 movies. So I think it's come down to a lot of these other ones we've mentioned for me. I'm also a fan of Gladiator, but in a higher tier are these three: The Martian, Thelma and Louise, and Black Hawk Down. I don't trust, you know, I'd have to revisit Black Hawk Down. It's been so long. Thelma and Louise, it's probably been even longer. So I might go with The Martian just because it's the one I've seen most recently and I trust my opinion more there, but it really could be any one of those three. Let me just say The Martian. I'll say The Martian.
Okay. Really? I'm surprised. I mean, I recall a good favorable review from both of us, but I wasn't sure you'd have it that high.
All right, fine. It's Thelma and Louise.
Okay. That was easy. Vote now and leave a comment at filmspotting.net.
She was to become one of the world's great storytellers. But her greatest story was her own. From acclaimed director Jane Campion comes an extraordinary film about a most remarkable woman.
We get back to our Jane Campion oeuvre view with the trailer there for 1990's An Angel at My Table, a biopic about New Zealand writer Janet Frame, based on Frame's three-volume autobiography. Campion originally envisioned it as a three-part TV miniseries. It was eventually combined into a single film with three actresses playing Frame at different points in her life: Alexia Keough as a child, Karen Ferguson as a teen, and Carrie Fox as an adult. Angel had its international debut at the Venice Film Festival, where it was rapturously received, famously losing out on the festival's top prize to the outrage of the audience, which protested the loss with shouts of "Angel," Sam, our producer, tells us. How about that? The film, though, won Best International Film Prize at the Chicago Film Festival, where, you know, we always know what we're doing, so that makes
sense. Of course. Frame's life, as I'm sure we'll get into, was filled with tragedy and suffering, including the death of two siblings and 8 years institutionalized in an asylum. There are a lot of places we could start, Josh, but as I hit play on An Angel at My Table a few days ago over on the Criterion Channel, I was thinking about this being a biopic, even if it's a biopic about someone I've never heard of until seeing the movie. And I know how much you tend to get irritated with biopics, and we rail on them a little bit and how conventionally these stories are often told. I'm dying to hear what you make of a Jane Campion biopic.
Yeah, great question. I mean, you may have hit on something. I think it does really help if it's someone who you're not familiar with.
Maybe.
Because you don't feel like I know the beats that are coming.
Yep.
So that might have helped a little bit. Here's the dilemma with this movie, Adam, is if you told me like right now that Jane Campion was going to make a biopic of someone who I was familiar with, I would kind of sigh. Like, I don't want Jane Campion making a biopic. Mm-hmm. But if I have to watch a biopic, I mean, I'd rather watch one by Jane Campion. So I think that's the dilemma I sort of faced with An Angel at My Table. And, you know, there's no denying that this is a more staid film than Sweetie, which is what we began with, her debut, where it was such a bolt of pure artistic vision.
Right.
But I also think that maybe this dramatizes Janet Frame's life in a way only Campion could. I think for me, at least, we get so many poetically evocative details of what this woman's life might have been like that strike me as pure Campion. We also get a lot of attention to the way, just an understanding, not attention, like an intrinsic understanding of the way gender can function as a trap. And I think those are the things that for me elevated this from the genre constraints that usually, even though it has some of them, you know, and maybe we'll get into this. I think there are some points where you do feel the biopic constraints, but Campion manages to elevate the material above that, which we should say it's also written. She's working from a script here, not her own script, but one by Laura Jones.
Yeah, that was something I was very aware of as I was taking notes and seeing the opening credits. And you say, okay, not only is this a biopic, but this is Campion not writing her own material as she did with Sweetie. Are we going to see some kind of disconnect there? Are we not really going to see what we would maybe expect even after just that debut of Campion's vision? And you alluded to this. I don't think there's any way you can say that An Angel at My Table is as bold visually as Sweetie. I don't think it takes as many chances. I will go back to your comment about when you don't know the subject and the impact that has on you as a viewer. One of the things I was thinking about and jotted down near the end of the movie is that I felt watching An Angel at My Table that it would have been still just as interesting if the character we were watching wasn't actually famous, was just a fictional character who lived this life, which may be another way of saying, though, what you said, which is that's almost the experience you have watching it, because you do have no frame, no pun intended, no frame of reference for this character at all. You don't know those beats. So it feels to you just the same as it would watching a completely fictional character on screen. But I think that what does maybe elevate An Angel at My Table above common biopic fare are two things. One, the way it does tie back to Campion and her body of work, which, again, even though I've seen some other films, I'm really going only off of Sweetie last week because that is what's most prevalent in my mind. And then the way, at least in one major way, I think it departs from traditional biopics beyond just the fame or notoriety of the main character. And that's the, I suppose, matter-of-factness with which Campion portrays this artist's, not only their life, but really their transformation into an artist.
Yeah.
I was just very struck, Josh, by how everything in An Angel at My Table, and it is a piece that's divided into three parts as the original source material was, it's a trilogy. I was struck by how effortlessly we transition not only between those parts, but between the transitions of her own life and what you would expect from a movie about a very well-known or very prominent writer, is for there to be those kind of aha moments.
Yes.
The ones where the character, oh, they put it all together, or they're given their big shot, and the book that's going to bring them all their fame and attention gets published and all the trappings that come with that. And all of those moments, and there are moments that depict those types of experiences for the character, but they are all so downplayed, and they are portrayed in exactly the same way all of her other life experiences are portrayed, that they're just part of life. They're just part of the fabric of this woman's life. And you don't even get the sense of how much work she's turning out, how popular it necessarily is, other than a few comments here and there. It's almost as if the thing that's supposed to be the most interesting thing about her, the movie is in some ways not all that interested in, which is the way her fame actually, I suppose, is expressed.
Matter of fact is such a great way to describe it. I was trying to think of how to locate why this felt so different from other biopics. And you're so right. Like, everything that the Hollywood biopic would hit happens off screen. I mean, I was kind of confused. This is my second time seeing it, but it's been a while, so I didn't remember all the beats. I was confused and not quite sure. Her suicide attempt is just kind of referenced by another character.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we realize, oh, like, we knew she was struggling. That's been clear in the details Campion gives us in the performance. At this point, it's Carrie Fox, which is a very, like, raw nerve performance. We'll probably get into that. But you know this character is struggling. But still, it took me aback. Like, oh, wait a minute. Like, that happened? Similarly, as you alluded to, when she is in this hospital, the psychiatric hospital, for a number of years, Campion is paying attention to things like the dehumanizing shapelessness of the hospital gowns. And then there's an offhand reference to the fact that, oh, she's been published. Oh, she won a prize.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know? And at first I was thinking, because I've been so trained by Hollywood biopics, where are these gaps? Like, why are we not, this felt, initially my instinct was this felt like a fault. Like, these are gaps. Then I realized, I wonder if what the film is doing is giving us these years as Janet Frame may have experienced them. This sort of fog of psychiatric care, quote unquote care, that she was undergoing, the losses in her family that were maybe, it doesn't downplay her. We'll get to this because the ending, I think, ends, this comes to a triumphant conclusion that is such a model for how biopic should act, that is all about her art. So this movie does not downplay her art or how important that was in her life at all. But it also, as you said, puts it in perfect context with everything else that is happening to her family and just her daily life in this hospital. Like, that is important too. And I came to kind of appreciate that as this is almost more of a sense of, if we don't always fully realize what is happening to Janet Frame in this movie, it's because she maybe doesn't always fully realize it herself.
Yeah.
This is a woman who because of her social anxiety, which makes her debilitatingly passive, because of her gender, which, you know, means that she's going to be manipulated by forces outside of her control. She kind of finds herself in places she's been put rather than places she intended to go.
Absolutely.
And the movie captures that, you know, and that's what makes it feel a little destabilizing compared to a standard biopic, but I think might be truer to, as you said, I have no idea, but maybe truer to Frame's real experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of those transitions as well. And of course, as we unpack the movie a little bit and we understand more about Frame's character and her diagnosis or misdiagnosis, this makes sense. But even the revelation that she is mad, that she needs to be institutionalized, is portrayed in a way that is kind of shocking in its pedestrianness or how mundane it is. We have seen that she is, I think fair to say, a little bit of an odd duck as a girl. She's someone who stands out, and she is someone who doesn't behave necessarily just like all of the other kids or even within the framework of her family. But it's as if all of a sudden the world decides that she needs to be put away, and yes, she just kind of rolls with that.
Kind of like the world decides she needs to be a teacher. She's smart enough to go to school, but oh, obviously you should be a teacher.
Yeah, and I think there are so many comparisons of other films dealing with artists and their dealings with mental illness. And again, I'll note the difference may be that they truly were mentally ill, and perhaps the suggestion here is that she really wasn't, that it was a complete misdiagnosis. But we don't get kind of those typical cliche introductions of that madness, the sense that, oh, this is definitely going to lead to her being hospitalized probably at some point or struggling her whole life. Just like all these other transitions we've mentioned, just one day, like anything else, just like going to school, she's in a hospital.
Yeah.
The movie treats it again with that kind of matter of factness. So I think that is interesting and is definitely a departure from the norm with this type of material. But the other thing that stands out, having just watched Sweetie, is the ways this movie connects back to Campion's debut. And you realize, oh, okay, this isn't just Campion. And I don't know any of the history behind the making of this movie or why she accepted the project, but Sweetie was clearly this very personal film. We talked about the note at the end of the film even, and it was written and directed by her. And here she's taking on this material. But this isn't just her as a hired gun or maybe finding something that seems like it's close to her heart. You're watching this film and recognizing, again, this appreciation for eccentrics, mm-hmm. for a woman who is an outsider. Just like Sweetie, not only Sweetie, but just like Kay in Sweetie. They're both eccentric outsiders. They're on the fringe. They're outcasts. And that is who Janet very much is. Like Sweetie, this is a film that not only depicts sex in a similar, frank way, like we talked about, in a lot of ways, the movie is obsessed with sex, just as Sweetie is. You know, like it drives a lot of the conflicts between characters in Sweetie. And here we recognize it is not only something that's part of her life as a young girl, something that she's always kind of vaguely encountering, but she's gone most of her life, as she articulates, being sexless and has really just been wanting that type of connection and to feel what so many other people feel. So I'm thinking about Sweetie the whole time. And then, of course, what I really realize, Josh, is that An Angel at My Table and Janet Frame seems to me the embodiment of Sweetie. Her madness, her type of madness, her artistic temperament, just if Sweetie actually had the talent to back it up.
Mm.
Janet Frame ends up similar to maybe not the exact circumstances we see at the end of the movie, Sweetie, Josh, but she's going to end up exactly the same as Sweetie, a doomed, tragic figure. And instead, she's a triumphant figure, but only because, and I love your point about how sort of passively she falls into so many of these things. It really is just about kind of where the world takes her and who she encounters, and she goes with it as opposed to her actively making those things happen. But she has the ability. She actually has the writing talent to write herself out of her circumstances.
Yes.
And that's what Sweetie doesn't have. So we're seeing a similar character in so many ways, but with one key advantage that I think Campion gets to play with here a little bit.
Can I cap off your comparison with
sure.
where the, I mean, they both end in the same place, a family member's backyard.
Yeah, good
and,
point.
And it's exactly the opposite ways you just described, whereas Sweetie ends in tragedy. And I'm not trying to say it's simply because Sweetie didn't have the same talent as Frame, but it's just how these pictures diverge.
Right.
Frame mm-hmm. finds herself in heaven, her version of heaven. She's living with a family member. This is her sister's, her grown sister's backyard, living with a family member who loves her, cares for her, but just leaves her alone. Just she's in this camper and she can have her time and she can just write. And that's that scene reminded me why I put actually this movie appeared on a top five list I did, top five movies about writers way back in 2013. And watching this again, I was like, oh, that's why I remembered I wanted this movie, because that scene is such a perfect encapsulation of, you know, in my experience, the joy of just writing. You're alone. You've got your space. You've got your mm-hmm. thoughts. She's out in that backyard. She had just been hanging out with her niece, younger girl. They've been listening to, I think, The Twist, right? Chubby Checker or no, I think it's a cover. Yeah. Isn't it
it's
a cover?
It's a different version,
yeah,
but it's
yeah.
The Twist, yeah.
And the niece is dancing and the niece has to go to bed. So Janet Frame is alone in the backyard and she tries dancing herself. And suddenly you see it, that bolt of an idea strikes. And she goes, runs back into her little camper, starts typing away. We hear her say, I think it's like, hush, 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 some of the words. And she gets this smile on her face. And you just think, this is all this woman wanted, this extremely talented wanted, is a safe space to be left alone to write. And I just love where this movie ends. It's so much better than where so many biopic ends, with Janet Frame earning an award and everyone stands right. up and applauding for her, right?
Yeah.
But it does
yeah.
the same thing. It does the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. And I think if I was going to include now a movie like An Angel at My Table on a top five list of movies about writers, I would probably call out scenes like the ones where we get the discussion before she's, quote unquote, a writer, before she's a published writer, before she is actually known for it or getting paid for it. She, as a young girl, is discovering words. Is just discovering the difference in a sentence or in a phrase or in any type of expression when you change a word. And not only that, there's a scene I love where I think it's really the first example of this, where she is exposed to poetry. She has an assignment at school and she has to finish a poem. She gets the kind of opening two lines. And doesn't she want to say something like touched by the sky or touches the sky? And her sister's like, no, you have to say tints the sky.
Yeah.
Tints is way more poetic. And the thing I really like about it, Josh, is I don't know whether or not tints was a more popular phrase back in that time or that place, or it was more commonly employed in poetry or not. I know that the sister thinks it's more poetic, and whether Janet thinks it is or not, what's more important to her is the personal choice.
Yeah.
The word that she thinks sounds best is the one she's going to go with. And notably, the movie doesn't call a lot of attention to it, but we're paying attention, of course, as viewers after that conversation and how adamant her sister was that she uses tints, that the next day when she reads it in class or it gets read in class, it's touches
yeah.
the sky. It's not tint. Like she,
right.
she stuck to her convictions and she went with the word that she thought was the right one to use there. And I appreciated that. I appreciated her admiration for words and how important it was to her to pick out the right one and to go with her instincts there.
I love that, because I actually thought tints was maybe better too.
Me too.
In terms of
right?
a word. But you're right. Like, that's not the point of the
it's
scene.
Not.
And who knows the context. Tints was maybe more common. I mean, that was kind of my impression. It's like, maybe this is
yep.
what everyone would do, but Janet is going to do something else.
Exactly. Exactly. I also wanted to mention, and you alluded to this earlier, the performance by Carrie Fox as the grown Janet Frame. I really love this performance. And I think it's just because of how purely, radiantly, also at times terrifyingly expressive she is. She seems like someone who is feeling everything in every moment. And
that, can't hide it.
And can't hide it, right? It just comes out of every pore of her body, and it is there on her face. And that distinction or the discrepancy between actual excitement and joy and genuine fear, it's sometimes hard to spot. And I think that makes sense for this character, right? Who was always, I think, walking that line.
Yeah. I think you describe it well, and it was interesting to hear you talk about the younger Janet, played by Alexia Keough, who was in that scene we were just talking about, writing the poetry, because I got a sense that, yes, she stood out a little bit, and partly because of this amazing, like, cumulous cloud of frizzy red hair, right?
Yeah.
So she's a target for teachers and others. Yeah. And
which also reminded me of Sweetie.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So that makes her stand out. But you also get a sense that, and the performance by this really great child actor gives us this sense that she thinks there might still be a place in the world for her. There's a little, despite what she experiences, there's still some confidence in that young Janet.
Yeah, you're right.
Then we cut and we get, you know, in between, we do get a few scenes during the teenage years with Karen Ferguson. But then when we do cut to Carrie Fox as Janet as a young adult, it's really harsh, because what we suddenly get is this woman who, the way I read it, suddenly realizes, I don't know where I belong.
Yeah.
This whole system that has been set up, and again, undercurrent primarily by men, there's no place for me. She is clinging to door frames. She's in back rooms eating alone over a book. She does not know how to interact. And I would say, you know, it's a very surface level, I guess, performance, but it has to be, because people feel this way.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a case of acting big. It's how the only way people who have this level of social anxiety can interact with the world. She wears her unease on her sleeve, mm-hmm. and she feels her outcast status so deeply in her bones. And so I do think it is, even though it's jarring to make that jump from these younger Janets who still have a little bit of kind of hope for where they could end up, to this older Janet who has no idea where she might fit, which speaks to the point of her, I don't want to describe her as passive entirely by being buffeted in the world, because she does have that. There's that long sequence where she takes this scholarship to go abroad on her own. And that shows you, she goes to Europe, that there is somewhere in her an adventurous, independent spirit. It's just, you know, again, the social constructs combined with her social anxiety make it difficult for her to do that. And really, I came out of this movie thinking what a miracle it was. If this is true, again, it's a dramatized biopic, but if this is true to the experiences of Janet Frame, what a miracle it was. She was so prolific, looking at the number of, you know, novels. And
I was shocked. I went to Wikipedia, it's like insane. Probably we all did. And you go, oh, the movie doesn't begin to even hint at the depth of her work.
And all, you know, for someone who was experiencing life in this way to manage to create so much is miraculous.
Yeah. An Angel at My Table is currently streaming on the Criterion Channel, and it's available for digital rental. Next week, we will get to Campion's big breakthrough, 1993's Oscar-winning The Piano. Will I come around? Will I make Josh happy? Will we go 3-for-3 in agreeing on Campion Pictures? You will just have to tune in to find out. More information about our Campion OOV review, including the full lineup and where to watch the movies, is available at filmspotting.net/Campion. That's our show, Josh.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. And you can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll. What is Ridley Scott's third best movie? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in wide release this weekend. Okay, Josh, it's the multiplex test. You could actually go to the multiplex and experience this. The Addams Family 2. And I'm actually not meaning to be dismissive of any of these films. I'm just curious which one you would be most interested in seeing.
This isn't the Addams Family 2. This isn't a Nerf gun to my head situation.
It is not. Yeah, well done. The Many Saints of Newark, The Sopranos prequel, or Venom, Let There Be Carnage. Which one are you going to?
Missed Adam's Family One.
Yeah, me too.
Missed
Venom.
Missed the first Venom. Am a Sopranos completist. So I don't feel like I need in my life this, The Many Saints of Newark. Respect, I mean, obviously respected the original series. But I think that's where I'm going to go just because I have the most interest based on my past.
Yeah, that's where I'm going as well. Now, did you know that the sequel to Venom was directed by Andy Serkis?
Well, that's really interesting. Has he done anything else? If you don't know, I will Google.
Yeah, you look it up while I take a look at what's coming out on digital. The Guilty, this is Antoine Fuqua directing. He made Training Day. He directs Jake Gyllenhaal in a remake of the 2018 Danish film about a cop recently demoted to emergency call operator who receives a call from a woman reporting her own abduction. That is The Guilty, Josh.
All right, Adam, we have no business doing what we're doing because this is actually Andy Serkis's 4th film as a director. Breathe, 2017. The Ruins of Empires TV movie, 2018, all per IMDb. Mm-hmm. And Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, 2018 as well. So he has been very busy these last couple of years as director.
I think you made up all of those titles. In limited release, Titan, the latest from Julia Ducournau. Next week here on Film Spotting, No Time to Die is opening. It'll probably be the following week before we get to review it here on the show. We will definitely get to the third movie in our Campion series, The Piano, and we'll have to see what else. Maybe a preview of the Chicago International Film Festival.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Kat Sullivan. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.